Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. This will be our final Talking History program, not only of the year, but also of the millennium. So to mark this special occasion, I've invited two individuals with whom you're already familiar to join us. They are Eileen Dugan and Dennis Mihalik, who are not only interviewers for the show, but also historians in their own right. I'll be talking with them about the major events of the past millennium. But before we do that, let's look back at an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week, in 1170, Archbishop Thomas Becket, the subject of the English classic Murder in the Cathedral by T.S. Eliot, was slain. A friend of Henry II, when he was appointed to the post of Archbishop, the two soon became enemies when Becket sought to protect church law from civil law, or more importantly, from the king's prerogative. On December 29, 1170, four men entered England's Canterbury Cathedral and murdered him. Becket became a martyr, and in 1173, a saint. Although he was never shown to have been directly involved in the murder, church and public opinion forced Henry to do penance at Becket's tomb. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, while we are still welcoming the third, we report on a major effort to preserve history for the fourth millennium. The effort is being made by the New York Times, and we have on the phone Times Capsule Project Manager Stephen Mim. Welcome, Stephen.
Hi, thanks.
Stephen, what's this project all about? Why are you doing it?
Well, the magazine here at the Times had originally decided to have an issue devoted to what people in the year 3000 would want to know about us. The more we did, the more we realized it would be more interesting if we actually created some kind of receptacle to convey that message to the future, and that's exactly what we did.
Tell us about the capsule.
It's about 3,500 pounds. It's made of stainless steel and designed by the Spanish architect Santiago Calatrava, who was the winner of an international design competition featuring a little under 50 architects and designers from around the world.
Well, what are you going to put in it?
Well, we've got a number of things, and some of it's still up for grabs, and that it's on display right now at the American Museum of Natural History, and people can visit and suggest things. But so far, what we've done is we've collected, for example, hair samples from around the world. People who worked at the United Nations were kind enough to donate a few follicles of their hair. The idea here being that hair can actually tell people 1,000 years from now a great deal about what we were eating, what kind of toxins were in the air, and give some sense of the genetic profile of the world back in the year 2000. Aside from that, we've also got a lot of documents, including issues of the magazine, inscribed on something called the HD Rosetta Disc, which is a nickel disc that has microscopic images micro-engraved onto the metal. So it's essentially like microfilm, but is on metal and is virtually indestructible. It was first developed by the Defense Department to protect against document loss in the event of the thermonuclear war. So we're betting that that, at least among all the things we're putting in the capsule, makes it to the future.
Okay, well, when will you bury it and where?
We will be, that's a very good question, we will be depositing it, as we like to say, next spring, that is the spring of 2000, at the Museum of Natural History here in New York City. And the twist is that we're not going to bury it. It's true, time capsules, by and large, have been buried, but more often than not, they end up getting lost because they're improperly marked. So this particular capsule is going to be a public sculpture and is going to sit outside at the museum.
And the capsule is now on display at the museum?
That's right. It's at display at the museum until the end of March, right actually where the Shackleton exhibit was previously up until this past month.
Okay. Well, thank you, Stephen, and good luck with your project.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And that was Stephen Mim, New York Times Capsule Project Manager. And if you're interested in seeing the Times Capsule, it'll be on display at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City until March 26th of the year 2000. You're listening to Talking History.
Ask you just to say, what are you doing?
This week we mark the end of the second millennium and of what some historians call the American century. Here to help us take a look back at both are Talking History's historians, also Creighton historians, Drs. Eileen Dugan and Dennis Mihalik. Eileen, let's start with you. Just how did the people celebrate the end of the first millennium, or the start of the second, 1,000 years ago?
Oh, you mean Y1K?
Y1K.
Well, historians really differ in interpreting what happened in the year 1000. Some historians will say that there was mass hysteria, and some will say that nothing much happened at all. I think, from what I've been reading, something in between happened. There were some wandering preachers who were capitalizing upon some plagues, some famines that were occurring at the time, socioeconomic problems that were occurring at the time. We also have an appearance of Halley's Comet around 989. And, of course, comets are always seen as portents of doom. And there also was a comet appearing in the year 1000. So there apparently was some concern that something was going to happen. And, again, these wandering preachers, some bishops in cathedrals were also preaching that something was going to happen in the year 1000. But there wasn't any widespread fear. And they didn't seem to think that the world was necessarily going to end, just that something was going to happen. When the year 1000 came and went and nothing happened, then there were those who started to say, well, maybe we didn't mean the year 1000. Maybe we meant 1033, because, of course, that would be 1,000 years after the death of Christ. So they were already trying to waffle and cover up their tracks from trying to explain the year 1000 and something possibly happening.
Okay, that leads into the whole tradition of just repeatedly setting dates at different times for the millennium.
Exactly.
Okay, tell us, by your estimation, about some of the major events of the past 1,000 years that you feel maybe changed the course of history.
Well, I think that especially looking at what the period that we're living in now, especially looking at what is going on now, I think some of the major things that have happened that have changed the course of history would be, for example, the invention of movable type, that in order to get information out to the public more readily, I mean, this enabled, for example, the Reformation to spread its word very quickly in the 16th century. I think another very important aspect of this past 1,000 years would be, for example, the Crusades, in terms of not just this concept of Christians going to the East and trying to reconquer the Holy Land, but also in terms of the contacts that were actually made between East and West in the High Middle Ages. Another thing which I think is very important, of course, it would be in the 20th century, for example, World War I, which was very much a turning point, not just in technology, but also how people began to perceive war. War was no longer necessarily glorious, but we begin to see, especially after World War I, the advent of the anti-war literature questioning the whole principle of war. World War II, of course, is another major turning point. The civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s. I'm tending to get very modern in looking at these.
Well, you're also tying very much into technology and war.
Well, I guess that's where my mind is.
Right. And some of them are connected, like you mentioned, the movable type with the Reformation. Perhaps the Reformation wouldn't have happened without movable type.
Are
there any general movements other than wars that you feel were important during the millennium?
Well, I think perhaps the, once again, I'm going to the scientific revolution, another thing that had to do with science and technology and ideas. But the scientific revolution helped us to view not just ourselves, but the universe in a whole new way. I mean, if you're talking about Copernicus and Galileo and going on even through Newton and Harvey, with the circulation of the blood and bringing that idea to the West. Just, again, how we see ourselves, how we see the world around us is very important, and inspiring that curiosity in the universe. And, of course, there is the discovery of America and exploration in general in the 15th and 16th centuries. It's very, very crucial, of course.
It's interesting when we talk about scientific developments, when we talk about, for example, Newton or the idea of relativity in the 20th century. These are scientific ideas that change our way of thinking as well as looking at the universe itself.
Yes, and that's why I think that they're so important, because they do change just the way that we think. And I would say that this also, you know, just sending a man to the moon, the whole space exploration, now that too is not just that we did it, but that it opened our minds to seeing that there was more than what is just here on this Earth, but that there was something beyond, and that perhaps exploration can continue. And it's this idea that by exploring, we expand ourselves and our beings.
And similarly, the discovery of America is not just about the discovery of another continent, but really the linking of the world together under what they call the Columbian Exchange.
That's right.
Okay. Dennis, taking a look at the American century, I alluded to that earlier. Is it, in your mind, a valid concept?
Considering the American military and economic and even cultural power, more in the pop cultural realm, I think it is. The term is confusing, depending on who's using it and in what way. That is, it was first espoused, the term, the American century, interchangeably with the term the American experience by Henry Luce following World War II. And, of course, Henry Luce was the most preeminent publisher at the time, having founded Time magazine, Fortune magazine, Life magazine, Sports Illustrated, and, of course, all of that has gone on into the huge conglomerate of Time Warner today. Well, Luce spoke of the American century or the American experience. Now, in one way, in Western civilization, you look to France and Louis XIV as far and away the political, economic, and cultural giant of the century that everyone wanted to copy. Then in the 19th century, of course, it was Great Britain that had created, of course, an empire upon which the sun never set. Following the industrialism of the United States, its contributions to the victories in World War I, World War II, and now eventually, at the end of the century, the Cold War, the United States now stands in a similar position that France did in the 18th or Great Britain did in the 19th.
Okay, so you've mentioned a few of these already, but let me ask sort of two questions together. Is this idea of the American century coterminous? Does it begin in the year 1900 or 1901, or is there another point at which we start it? And given that, what were the major events in your mind that made this the American century?
Well, whomever is using the concept, in Henry Luce's mind, the victory in World War II all of a sudden now is the kickoff point where this is the American century and would continue indefinitely. So, I mean, in one way that I've looked at it, 2,000 years ago at the onset of the first millennium in the year 0 or 1, you had the concept of the Pax Romana. That is, all of Western civilization was dominated by the Roman Empire that established peace within its borders. Now, a lot of people hearing the American century are now thinking on into the 21st century, and is there going to be a Pax Americana in which the United States will do this for all of Western civilization?
Do you think that's likely to happen?
Luckily, as a historian, I always tell my students, history can't predict, and that's where I'm going to leave it. there are some indications that American power, economic power, cultural power, military power, will extend for centuries. Okay? So that, for example, if you look at just the 20th century, okay, I think that one of the least admired accomplishments of the United States is the phenomenal accomplishment of American democratic education, where at the beginning of the century, hardly 10% of the high school age students went to high school. By the end, now it's well over 90%, although we don't have that graduation rate, it's only in the 80 percentile. But nonetheless, and then a majority of those kids going on to college, I mean, it's a double-edged sword. You can berate American education for all of its failures, but nonetheless, in terms of providing opportunity, if not equal opportunity, but at least opportunity, and unleashing intellectual power in Western civilization never before seen, I think that's a heck of an accomplishment and bodes well for the future.
Okay. I don't know why you're afraid to look ahead. In a century, we'll talk about it and see if you got it right.
Okay.
I mean, let me get back to you and pick on something that Dennis alluded to here. He said the year zero or the year one. Have we got the date correct or not?
Well, it depends on which side you're coming from. This whole controversy over whether the century and the millennium turns at zero or at 01 is because of a poor fellow back in the 6th century named Denis the Short. He was a monk who was charged by the Pope to create a calendar and to create a chronology, really, of the world. Mm-hmm. And
no relative. I've done the genealogy.
No, you're certainly not Short. But anyway, poor Dennis, when he was putting together his chronology, decided that, well, Christ was born in the year one, so that the year before Christ's birth should be year one B.C. And unfortunately, he didn't put in a year zero, so that if you were to count 100 years from year one, that makes 101. If you make 2,000 years after Christ's birth, according to his calculations, it would be 2001. And so academics will say that 2001 is actually the beginning of the next millennium.
Okay, well, I gave Dennis the chance to look to the future. Let me give you just a moment. What do you think might be the major development of the next century or the next millennium that's going to change our lives?
Well, I have to go back to information again. I started by saying that information and the immovable type would be very important. I think that as computers continue to develop and as the technology continues to develop, it's going to have a great impact upon our lives, not just in terms of disseminating information, but also in gathering information about us. It's going to be, I think, harder and harder for us to move about privately without having computers track us.
Okay, and that's where we'll end it. Thank you, Eileen and Dennis, and Happy New Year and best wishes for the new millennium to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to historians Eileen Dugan and Dennis Mihalik, and this is Talking History. One of the great controversies of the 19th century followed us into the 20th, and it would seem will continue into the 21st, namely the controversy surrounding the teaching of evolution in the public schools. Here to provide his perspective on this now centuries-old debate is James Gilbert, Distinguished University Professor of History at the University of Maryland. Professor Gilbert is also the author of Redeeming Culture, American Religion in an Age of Science, published in 1997 by the University of Chicago Press.
The recent evolution dispute in Kansas is nothing new for our century. There have been other similar outbreaks of controversy, such as the trial of John Scopes in Tennessee in 1925. More important was the enforced silence because public school biology textbook publishers feared to mention Darwin or evolution over several decades after that infamous trial. The puzzle is why this persistent outrage over biological theory in a society that otherwise welcomes scientific and technological advance. The answer lies partly in symbolism. The evolution creation science debate suggests something deep and abiding in our culture. At its heart is a belief that shapes American identities and history. The story of creation places humans at the center of universal attention and natural order. Dominion over all the earth and every living thing in it has had particularly relevance to America, a nation built upon conquering other peoples and subduing a wilderness. To call humans just an intelligent species linked to others is to revoke those privileges of special creation. Even our national symbolic language is animated by phrases like exceptionalism and chosenness. We think of ourselves as a model for other societies, a hope and an inspiration sanctified by God's special denomination. To look more closely, the creation-evolution debate has been sustained by particularly American views of science and education. From the outset, objections to Darwinism rested upon two arguments. The first is the notion that science must be accessible and understandable to everyone. A science that appears otherwise, that is counterintuitive or illogical, must, so the argument goes, be wrong. This is an old idea grounded in the American Enlightenment, Scottish moral philosophy, and pragmatism, and it rests upon faith in the democratic implications of just plain common sense. The second reason has to do with governing American public schools. Most Americans would agree that what to teach and how to teach it remains a community choice, not to be imposed by some distant commission of scientists or experts. Argued from this perspective, creation science seems like a democratic defense of the local community. The irony of it all is that the alternative to evolution, that is creation science, goes well beyond a reaffirmation of biblical accounts of creation. Far more is asserted in modern creation science, and thus far more is conceded. To prove the validity of a faith account, creation scientists have to mount a case against the scientific account on its own terms. This is a daunting and contradictory challenge. Will progress ever end this debate? Perhaps so in the very distant future. But its contemporary fervor reminds us of one of the great truths of American culture in the 20th century. Science and religion coexist in our society because they coexist in individuals. When they clash, as they inevitably do around such issues as evolution, we are reminded of the explanatory power each explanation offers now and perhaps well into the 21st century.
You've been listening to James Gilbert, author of Redeeming Culture, American Religion in an Age of Science. This is Talking History.
When the bells all ring and the horns all blow, and the couples we know are fondly kissing, will I be with you, or will I be among the missing? Maybe it's much.
Finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions, in this case for the start of the new year. If you're one of those people who tend to remember successful assassinations, but not those that failed, you might want to refresh your memory by tuning in to History Channel's History's Mysteries on January 3rd for Failed Assassinations, the story of near misses on the lives of Presidents Andrew Jackson, Theodore Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Gerald Ford, and Ronald Reagan. And on January 8th and 9th, look for the History Channel's History Undercover. On January 8th, Declassified Human Experimentation will investigate the history of human experimentation in the United States during the Cold War. On January 9th, Sex and the Swastika will examine the bizarre sexual behavior of the German Nazis and the related methods used by the Americans and British to obtain vital information from them. Be sure to check your local listings for exact times. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show and that you will join us next week when we'll take a look at the life and legend of America's musical icon, Elvis Presley. In the meantime, I'd like to thank those whose extraordinary good efforts have kept us on the air every week for the past year, historians Eileen Dugan and Dennis Mihalik, as well as Terry Clark, who's abroad and could not join us today, our engineer Michael Hansen, and the rest of the staff at KIOS Radio here in Omaha, my assistant producer, Linda Mervish, Talking History's producer, Cindy Workman, and Creighton University for its generous support. And, of course, we thank all of our listeners and, as usual, invite you to send us your comments or suggestions to guide us into the new year, either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.